biosynthesis.
You're making what? NADPH. So that's photosystem what? One. Photosystem one. The terminus of photosystem one is the production of NADPH. So two electrons come from water through this process, and they end up reducing NADP and making hydride ions, and you make two NADPHs. There's a wide variety of metal-containing proteins that help guide those electrons. That pathway that terminates in the NADPH is called the non-cyclic pathway. So you get electrons that come in from PS2, land here at a relatively low energy, because they've passed through this Q pool. Now, what does this Q pool do? What does this Q pool do? What does it apparently do right here? You got protons in the stroma versus protons in the thylakoid. What do you think it's doing? Proton pumps. That's exactly correct. And as you know from the chemiosmotic theory, when you have proton pumps, you're actually going to ultimately produce what? Someone said it. A gradient. And you use that powerful gradient to produce what molecule? ATP. That's exactly right. So here you make the NADPH for reducing power. Here you make the ATP for other kinds of stuff. Okay? So you make ATP here and NADPH over here. Not the same place, but different locations. Now, notice here, if you would, they have something known as a... which means that electrons that are promoted from PS2 go down the energy pathway and are used to pump protons, ultimately land in PS1 and are promoted again. Those do not have a permanent fate of going to NADPH. They can be what? Shunted around and do what again? What? They can be shunted around and produce more pumping, which produces more ATP. So there you have the cyclic pathway and the non-cyclic pathway, PS1, either production of NADPH for the non-cyclic pathway or the production of proton gradient for ATP production in the cyclic pathway. All right, let's back up and take a look at PS2 then. PS2, of course, uses a little higher frequency of light, a little shorter wavelength to produce its energy. So you can see here that when a photon hits this PS2 complex, it produces a high-energy photon, a high-energy electron, which immediately gets shunted away from this. And so it basically leaves a hole here. When that electron gets promoted up to a high-energy state, it doesn't simply drop back down through fluorescence or thermal release. It gets shunted off to be doing something else, so it leaves a hole here. So what fills that hole? Well, that hole is filled by the actions of that OEC. And what did we say the OEC was? Begins with the word O, which stands for oxygen. E, which stands for what? Very close. Very close. Evolving. Evolving. And C, which stands for chocolate. Yes. Oxygen evolving chocolate. It doesn't sound like, it doesn't sound right, but it actually works pretty well. Other people might call it oxygen evolving complex, but since I like chocolate so much, I just call it oxygen-evolving chocolate. All right, so notice what, and I mentioned this last time, what trace mineral is in there, what trace metal? Manganese. One of the things about manganese is it has multiple oxidation states. Multiple oxidation states. That means you could remove one electron? Yes. Could you remove two electrons? Yes. How about three? Yes. How about four? Yes. It has all those oxidation states. One, two, three, and four. That's amazing, isn't it? A metal that has all those different oxidation states. You don't need a whole lot of it, but it works very, very, very well. And we'll see about the details of that in a little bit. So eventually, as these electrons get promoted, they extract electrons from the manganese to fill that hole. So the manganese goes through a variety of steps, each of those steps increasing the oxidation state, and eventually the oxidation state becomes so powerful that it can extract electrons from water and produce hydrogen ions and oxygen. So the oxygen you breathe actually is coming from what molecule? Ultimately, it comes from where? Water. Every oxygen molecule you're breathing is coming from the oxygen evolving complex. I ran today, 1.6 miles. Well, I didn't run the entire 1.6 miles, but I ran a good part of it. All right, so I used a lot of oxygen in that. And that all came from this oxygen evolving complex. Let's take a look at the details of that. This is actually what's happening. This is the chemiosmotic theory for plants. You will not need to memorize this. This is just a horrible mishmash of stuff. Although all of it's pretty important, and it's all going on right now, primarily in south of the equator, etc. So here you have the oxygen evolving complex. You have a photon landing there. Well, a photon landing in the PS2 complex, the electrons are promoted, leaves a hole, the oxygen evolving complex grabs an electron from the manganese increases its oxidation state by 1, and eventually it becomes so oxidized it can overcome the resistance of oxygen to being oxidized and removes 2 electrons, or 4 electrons in this case, to produce oxygen gas, which we're breathing right now, and 8 hydrogen ions. Those electrons then move through a complex in which they're pumped from the stroma into the thylakoid lumen and create a hydrogen ion gradient. Those electrons then move through a complex of PS2, where they're promoted again to a high reductive power electron, where they hit some more of these metal-containing cytochromes. They land on FADH, and then ultimately those electrons land on NADP+, to produce NADPH in the stroma, and proton pumping here, high concentrations of hydrogen ion in the thylakoid lumen. Here you go, this proton translocating ATP synthase. You can recognize, of course, this disc, rod, and ball-like structure that is very similar to what happens in mitochondria. Protons flow through it and produce ATP. And they're peppered all over that thylakoid lumen. And therefore, in the stroma, that is the area outside of those flat discs, have both a high concentration of ATP and NADPH. And, of course, there are transporters that move that outside of the chloroplast for the plant cell to use. All right. Now, here is the oxygen-evolving complex that they found through careful experimentation. Oxidation of water occurs in a 5-stage reaction. EOC is the oxygen-evolving complex of PS2. The discovery of oxygen-evolving complex came through light flash experiments. Amount of oxygen released by dark adapted plants peaked every 4 flashes after the initial 3. So 1, 2, 3, oxygen yield. 1, 2, 3, 4. So there's something that was going on here. Flash, flash, flash. Flash, flash, flash. So there's 2 sets of 3, and then it began to turn into two sets of 4. And the model they've come up with looks like this. The oxygen evolving complex has 5 states, S0 to S4. How many states? 5. Beginning with what? S0, not S1, S0, and ending with what? S4. All right? And it apparently, it's stable, its resting state is S1 right here, based on the oxygen flash, flash experimentation. So the resting state, where it normally exists, is there in a single electron. Now, so a photon hits this. Is this is what actually happening? Is a photon hitting the manganese? Or is that just graphical representation of what's happening to PS1, PS2? Why is there a photon hitting this manganese complex model? Is it actually hitting the manganese? Say no. No, what's it actually hitting? Chlorophyll. And what happens to that electron when it hits that, when the photon hits that chlorophyll, what happens to an electron? It goes up, and then does it fall back down to the same place? No, it gets shunted off. Well, that again, that leaves a hole there at that low energy, at that chlorophyll. Where do you think that, so that photon hitting this, is that photon actually hitting that, or is it hitting the PS2? Say it's hitting PS2. Thank you very much. It is, actually. And write that down. So it's not hitting the complex, it's actually hitting PS2. But the equivalent is the loss of an electron from PS2 that's been promoted leaves a hole, electron moves over to, over here. Another photon hits. Guess what happens? Photon hits the PS2, gets promoted, shut it off, leaves a hole. The electron to replace that comes from oxidation state 1 moving to oxidation state 2. Another photon hits PS2. The electron is promoted, removed, leaves a hole. The electron is filled by electrons from manganese. Another photon hits the PS2, another hole at low energy, electrons, gets promoted, shunted off, leaves a hole. The electron is filled by manganese state, moving from S3 to S4. At this point, the oxidation state of manganese is strong enough to overcome the resistance of water, and it strips the electrons away from the oxygen, releases the oxygen, releases hydrogen ion, and goes back to its zero state. So notice here, you are producing 4 hydrogen ions, 2 oxygen, which release, and a bunch of electrons. Where do those electrons go typically? They end up in PS2, they pump protons, and they get promoted by PS1, and they ultimately end up as NADPH. Okay. Of course, if you don't need NADPH, those electrons eventually cycle through to make ATP and make water again, just like in the electron transport system in the mitochondria. So, it contains manganese ions, calcium ions, and chloride ions. Very handy, but it's a manganese ion. What ion is it? Is it manganese or is it magnesium we're talking about right here? What actually releases oxygen from water? Manganese or magnesium? Manganese. Is there a difference between manganese and magnesium? Yes. Could you put manganese in chlorophyll? No. Manganese in chlorophyll? No. And have it operate as chlorophyll? No. Now, you can put magnesium in chlorophyll. That's fine. That's the normal state. What happens if you put iron in a chlorophyll-like molecule? What do you get? Hemoglobin. Now, okay. So we're seeing this again. So you see here, non-cyclic produces reduced NADP plus, which is NADPH. Dependent on prior electrons from the oxidation of water. 1 ATP is 1 1/4 ATP per absorbed photon. 8 photons required per oxygen produced. Cyclic pumps hydrogen ions from the stroma into the thylakoid lumen. Not dependent on PS2. So you can actually have this cyclic process occurring without PS2 if you're just cycling electrons. You don't have to have fresh electrons. But if you're going to be making NADPH, you have to have fresh electrons. You get those fresh electrons from water. Fresh electrons from water. All right. The dark reactions. I am your father, Luke. No! You can't be my father. Obi-Wan Kenobi would have told me. Any rate, so these are not the same dark reactions. I think I've watched Star Wars a little too much. That's okay. Do I have one more on that? One more? Ah, excellent. Okay, now then, dark reactions. Guess what the dark reactions do? Well, according to what's listed up here, what do the dark reactions do? Well, they take the NADPH and the ATP you make, and they reduce carbon dioxide, and they make it into GAP, which is GAP, which stands for what? That's right. So you make glycerylated 3-phosphate from carbon dioxide. So you're making a 3-carbon unit from carbon dioxide. And thank you very much. That's life. All right, then you take rearrangement of 6 GAPs into 1 GAP and 3 ribulose 5-phosphates. Ribulose 5-phosphates? Where have I seen ribulose 5-phosphates before? What is it? Pentose phosphate pathway. You mean to tell me? Yes, we came from plants. That's what the evolutionary biologist would tell you. Where'd my green go? I have no idea. So someday in the future, you're going to find a skeleton they'll attribute to the jolly green giant. Don't you think? The big guy with the green thing and the vegetable. Sorry. I got off thing. All right. The key enzyme is ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase. Say, ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase. Say it again. Ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase. You also sometimes hear it called ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxidase. That oxidase function is a mistake, oddly enough, but a very important mistake. Name the one enzyme that all of life is dependent on. Ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxidase. Why? It's the one enzyme that captures carbon dioxide and makes carbohydrate. Every sugar, every fat, every protein you eat, the carbon from that has come from ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase. Most abundant protein in the world, nearly all life depend on this enzyme, for as important as it is, a very low catalytic efficiency, about 3 reactions a second. During bright sunlight and a warm sunny day, up to 50% of all leaf protein is ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase. Now, sometimes they call it ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxidase, Rubisco. Say Rubisco. So, it rhymes with, but it's not. It's, okay. So, yes, Rubisco. Not surprisingly, it requires magnesium ion as a cofactor. 3 carbon dioxides, 9 ATP, 6 NADPH, makes a GAP, 9 ADP, 8 phosphates, and 6 NADP pluses. The 2 GAPs then form what? What's G1P? What's G1P? You're killing me, guys. What's G1P? Glucose 1-phosphate, which goes, as you know, onto a host of cellular activities. Now, why is it called the dark reactions? Well, in the early days, they could feed the plant NADPH and ATP, and it would make this stuff in the dark. But, therefore, they called it dark reactions because it was not completely dependent on the presence of light, such as photosynthesis is. But nevertheless, the vast majority of dark reactions occur during photosynthesis, when light is present. So don't get confused. The dark reactions simply are a misnomer from the early research. That dark reaction is also called the what? What's that cycle called? Calvin cycle. When I say dark reactions, you say Calvin cycle. Dark reaction. Dark reaction. Calvin cycle. Thank you very much. But not surprising, the Calvin cycle must be shut down in the dark. Huh? It's called the dark reactions, but it's got to be turned off in the dark. Notice the misnomer? So why must the Calvin cycle be shut down in the dark? You don't have ATP. You need ATP and NADPH. If you tried to operate in the dark, where would you get that stuff from? Carbohydrate. The plant would be eating itself to produce the reduced materials in ATP to make more of itself. it would be a completely useless, inefficient cycle. So the dark reactions are shut down in the dark. All right. Rubisco responds to three light-dependent conditions. pH with light, comma. The pH of the stroma rises from 7 to 8 because they're being pumped out of the stroma. Near Rubisco, pH optimum, magnesium ion is a proton pumped out of the stroma into the thylakoid. There's a transporter that magnesium enters into it. And then you've got this one covalent compound called CA1P, 2-carboxyarabinitol-1-phosphate, a compound synthesized only in the dark, inhibits Rubisco in the dark. And then you have this SBPase and SBPase. Ooh, SBPase. I wonder what SBPase stands for. S. Name a sugar that begins with the letter S. That's true. Let me rephrase that. Name a monosaccharide that begins with the letter S. Hint, it's in the pentose phosphate pathway. Cetohepchulose, exactly correct. Outstanding recall, good catch. Cetohepchulase, so, yeah, all right. Oh, all right, so here is the Calvin cycle. Guess what I've not asked you to memorize? Calvin cycle. Yeah, it's just the nature of the beast. All right, here we go. Let's run through this. Guess what the top phrase is? If, remember how they organized this? This is why I like this book, the Voet and Voet. They organize their figures so it helps you learn. Do you remember what the pentose phosphate pathway did? Remember how we organized it? There's a top row of reactions and then a bottom kind of block of reactions, how that works? What happened to the glucose-6-phosphate that entered into the top row of reactions? It was ultimately what? And the two words I'm going to use, you have a choice, oxidized or reduced. So glucose-6-phosphate along the top section was ultimately what? Oxidized or reduced? The glucose-6-phosphate was, I heard people say, reduced. Okay? That's incorrect, actually. The glucose-6-phosphate in the pentose phosphate pathway. Were you talking about this up here? Say yes. Yeah. Possibly. Possibly. Is it right if I say yes? Yeah. So, the glucose-6-phosphate gets changed into what? Glucose-6-phosphate gets changed into what in the pentose phosphate pathway? What's the final reaction in the top row? You made what? You made a 5-carbon compound named ribulose bisphosphate. Is that correct? So, the pentose phosphate pathway, that top row is oxidation. It's oxidation because you oxidize glucose and you make reduced NADPH. Guess what this reverses? Here you have an oxidized phosphoribulose, ribulose-5-phosphate-carboxylase, and guess what happens? This ribulose-5-phosphate-carboxylase gets carbon dioxide added to it, and you go from one molecule of 5 to two molecules of 3. So you go from one molecule of 5 to two molecules of 3. You do that 3 at a time. So you have 15 carbons right here with 3 carbon dioxides coming in here, making 6 molecules of 3, which is a total of 18 carbons. Now, what are you going to have to do to get this? Okay, these are fully oxidized. Notice the carboxylic acid there, carboxylic acid there. You make them high energy by adding 6 ATP. They make them 1,3-BPG. And then what do you do with that NADPH? You what? You reduce it. You reduce that carboxylic acid down to aldehyde, and off you go in the glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate gap. Okay? 6 of them. 6. Count them, 6. What are the fates of the 6, ladies and gentlemen? Well, there's 2 right there, 1 there and 2 there. So 5 of them go on to rearrange themselves, and 1 of the 3 goes on to be the products. So these products, you can shunt over here and say, glucose and fat and DNA and any kind of number of things. Okay, these five then go through a variety of reactions, and one of which, of course, uses this acetoheptulose 7-phosphate. You know, I love these things. Anyway, so five threes get made into three. Five threes get made into three fives. Thank you very much. That's the non-oxidative portion of the Calvin cycle. Very similar to the pentose phosphate pathway, which is where you get three fives get made into two tens. I like it. I've never heard of a 10-carbon sugar. It's probably out there. Let's try that again, though. Very humorous. Okay, so the pentose phosphate pathway takes three fives and makes it into two something and one something else. Remember what it was? Three fives is how many carbons total? 15. So we need to figure out what makes 15 carbons. Two sixes and 1 3. In comparison to this. So, I'm not going to ask you to memorize. I obviously did not ask you to memorize this, but I need to know that you know what the whole basic idea of this is. You take three fives, make it into six threes with carbon dioxide being added, and notice what enzyme does that? Ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxidase. And so here comes carbon dioxide. You take the RUBP, you make 3PG, add ATP and NDP, which makes gaps. One gap goes on to make carbohydrates, and the rest of the plant, the rest of it goes back to the recycle. Happens over and over, you make tons of this carbohydrate. And also what happens here is the very act of photons hitting a leaf cause a cascade of electron transport, which ultimately begins to land on this ferredoxin thioreductase, which then reduces thioredoxin, and that thioredoxin then reduces the bisphosphatase, which is a bisphosphatase. Where is this bisphosphatase? Right here, this thing, acetoheptulose bisphosphatase, and makes it active. So this whole process, the Calvin cycle, is active only when light is present, despite the fact it says dark reactions. All right. Secondary regulatory system, thioredoxin. Reduced thioredoxin activates FBPase and acetoheptulose phosphatase by disulfide interaction. Nope. Okay. Thus, in plants, light stimulates the Calvin cycle while deactivating glycolysis, whereas darkness has the opposite effect. Dark reactions don't occur in the dark. Dark reactions don't occur in the dark. Okay, and you can follow this through, read that in the text. Let's go ahead, shall we, ladies and gentlemen? Photorespiration. How far do I go on this? Okay, right there. Photorespiration. What in the world? What are you doing right now? That's technically called respiration, is that right? You take in complex carbohydrates and you release what? Carbon dioxide because of the presence of oxygen. That's called respiration. But Dr. Novak, that Rubisco, it isn't going to use oxygen, it's going to use carbon dioxide. Because Rubisco is designed to capture carbon dioxide. It would never use oxygen. Unfortunately, that's incorrect. Rubisco, in fact, does use oxygen, apparently as a protective effect. Let's take a look. At low concentrations of carbon dioxide and high concentrations of oxygens, leaves begin to consume oxygen and release carbon dioxide. Huh? If you have, let's say you have a very efficient sugar cane, you could actually measure a slight increase in the concentration of oxygen around in large groves of sugar cane, especially if there's not much wind. There's a lot of photosynthesis going on in sugar cane. And you can sense, you can actually detect a slight increase in carbon of oxygen. You can sense a slight decrease in carbon dioxide as well. Does the sun turn down? Does it go into a shade mode when plants begin to receive light? Is there any way that a leaf can prevent itself from having photons hit it? No. It's just standing out there. We as mammals can move under a tree, but what does a tree do when it's getting hit by all that hot heat and sunlight? It just has to stand there and take it and provide us shade. Thank you very much, trees. I like trees. But what are they doing? They're getting hit with all this light energy, and yet there's not enough carbon dioxide to make sugars. So rather than going through a process of photobleaching because of the excess energy, what it does, it begins to use oxygen as an alternate substrate for Rubisco. It's a worse than useless reaction if you look at the net effect of it, but if you're worrying about maintaining the integrity of the enzyme, ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase, it apparently works. So, Rubisco, ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxidase called Rubisco, and this occurs in the peroxisome in the mitochondria. It uses up NADPH and ATP, and apparently this is the idea, maybe used to dissipate light energy in bright reactions. So you can see that. So it'll absorb oxygen, release carbon dioxide through this process. I'm not going to ask you to memorize it. You just need to know that photorespiration. What's photorespiration in plants? How would you describe it? The absorption of oxygen and the release of carbon dioxide by the plant in response to excess sunlight. The release of carbon dioxide, the absorption of oxygen in response to an excess amount of sunlight. It apparently has some sort of protective effect. Because what they do is, you can take a plant, you can take a leaf, put it in oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere, no carbon dioxide, hit it with sunlight, it bleaches right out. Actually, I take that back. You put it in a pure nitrogen atmosphere with pure nitrogen, neither oxygen nor carbon dioxide, hit with light, it bleaches right out. The chlorophyll is just destroyed by the presence of light. If they add oxygen to that leaf, it still stays green. So there's something about a protective effect with oxygen. All right. Now then. Okay, C4 plants. Ever heard of C4 plants? All right, C4 plants. Bright sunlight, photorespiration equals photosynthesis, many plants. Very nice. In other words, you have almost as much photorespiration as you do photosynthesis. This is very inefficient. C4 plants, the sugarcane, corn, and most important weeds. Yay. You wonder why your weeds take over your bluegrass lawn? Is because they're about twice as efficient in capturing carbon dioxide and sunlight. All right, concentrate carbon dioxide to almost totally prevent photorespiration. You mean to tell me that plants are doing the exact same thing we are worrying about? Yes, they intentionally concentrate carbon dioxide around Rubisco to increase its efficiency. There are certain greenhouses that they seal the greenhouse and release carbon dioxide into the greenhouse. It accelerates plant growth. So, concentrate the carbon dioxide, almost totally prevent photorespiration. C4 plants have a unique anatomy. A single layer of bundle sheath cells is surrounded by a layer of mesocells. The mesophyll cell assists by capturing the carbon dioxide as malate. Malate's carried to the bundle sheath cell. It's released and enters in the Calvin cycle. In other words, there's a structure in plants that captures the carbon dioxide, takes it directly to the Rubisco enzyme and dumps it there, and bing, the Rubisco enzyme captures it and creates that carbohydrate that the plant needs. Carbon dioxide is released, captured by the Rubisco, enters the Calvin cycle, etc. C4 plants consume 5 ATP per fixed carbon dioxide. C3 plants, which is all of our plants like bluegrass, most ornamental plants, consume 3 ATPs per fixed carbon dioxide. Why would C4 plants have the advantage in tropical regions? They do have it. Why do they have it? If you have lots and lots of sunlight, 12 hours of sunlight every day, 365 days a year, are you going to have, as a plant, trouble making ATP? No. You're not going to have any trouble making ATP in the tropical regions. And therefore, does it matter if the C4 plant uses 5 ATP per every CO2? Not particularly. They can make more. Okay, so the C3 plants are more efficient, which helps them in reduced sunlight areas, like in the semi-tropical and northern latitudes, where sunlight is much less prevalent, but it's slightly less efficient in terms of capturing carbon dioxide because it relies on the amount of carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere. All right, and you can see this. I'm not going to ask you to memorize this. I do want you to understand the process of what a C4 plant is. C3 plants have the advantage in cooler regions. Why is that? I just mentioned it. I gave it away. All right, CAM plants. CAM. What does CAM stand for? Say Crassulean. Crassulean. Acid metabolism. I've been mispronouncing that for years. CAM plants. Variation of C4. Where do you find it? In succulent plants in the desert. All right? What's the problem with succulent plants in the desert? They have more than enough light, but what are they missing? Water. So do they want carbon dioxide entering in and water being released? No. So they close up at night. They capture the carbon dioxide this CAM material, and capturing is malate, prevents water loss during the day. Malate is broken down to carbon dioxide. Daytime, malate is broken down to carbon dioxide and PEP with carbon dioxide being fixed as GAP. So they capture the carbon dioxide at night and release it during the day when the sunlight is. All right, we're done with that, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. Now, we went through that pretty quick, Dr. Novak. Does that mean it's unimportant? That all of that's important, ladies and gentlemen. It's very, very important. I need for you to review photosynthesis just as I have it here. Now then, I have cookies for you guys. I want you to pass one around. Okay? Grab a cookie, but don't eat it. Grab a cookie if you want to. I want you to strip it open. And I'm going to put it here, even though it's kind of dirty. It doesn't matter. Lipid metabolism. How many of you love lipids? Oh, I love lipids. There's nothing better than a good lasagna that's all caked and clogged with lipid, known as fat, but lipid nevertheless. And so we need to understand how all that gets processed. Come on, quickly pass this around. Come on, 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 come on. All right, everybody should get one. Take one down, pass it around. Yes, you have a question? Yes. Chapter 20 is on the test next week. Outstanding. Yes, not yet. Did you already scrape off a little bit? Oh, man. Guys. Come quickly, are there more? Is there still some enough around? I hope. You don't have to have one if you don't want. Okay, take one, pass it. Daniel, go over and grab one if you want before it disappears. Bring it over here. These gentlemen over here are starving. They need some lipid here. All right, lipid metabolism, ladies and gentlemen. Again, this is given to you. I gave you the whole thing on Moodle. On Moodle. All right. So, what is this soft interior consist of? Chocolate. Primarily, it's got chocolate flavoring in it, but primarily consists of what? Sugar and fat. Now, what's the difference between sugar and oil? I mean, what's the difference between fat and oil? Fat is solid at room temperature. That's right. So if this got hot, it would eventually melt and ruin the cookie. Is that correct? So it's actually a combination of a little bit of chocolate flavoring, a little bit of sugar, and a lot of fat in it, just plain old fat. Now, when you scrape this off, where does... Let's go ahead and let's take... I want you to scrape it off in your mouth and then hold it in your mouth. Okay. That's not bad. What do you notice about the texture? It's creamy. Do you sense a little graininess in it, maybe? A little bit of graininess? What do you think that graininess is? Sugar. Exactly right. But notice, if you would, as it was it a solid here in your on the cookie? And then when it got into your mouth, when it hit your mouth, what happened to it? Started what? Well, if they used the wrong shortening for this, could it get in your mouth and just stay a solid? If the melting point was not correct, could it stay a solid? Well, of course. Can you imagine them making a mistake and you have this luscious thing and you scrape it in your mouth and it stays there like a piece of wax? What? And you keep chewing on it and it doesn't melt. This shortening is highly regulated, and they manufacture this shortening they use in these cookies has a very specific temperature criterion for melting, for the melting temperature of it. It's got to be below the melting point. It's got to be above the room temperature, but below the mouth temperature. So tell me what's happening. Now, you just had that. What's happening to your saliva glands right now? Are they starting to produce saliva? Yeah. Now, the saliva has what enzyme in it? Is that acting on the fat? No, because it acts on what? Carbohydrate. So there's actually, however, an acid label lipase secreted in the back of the tongue. Yes. As that fat slipped past your tongue. And notice how, wasn't that a delightful sensation? Oh my goodness. I'm sorry. Wasn't that a delightful sensation? Yes, it was. And let me turn off my phone. I thought I turned it off once already. Okay. Okay, so it's secreted and immediately begins acting on the fat that you have there. Completion of digestion and absorption of lipid takes place primarily in the lumen of the small intestine. So there is a like what they call a salivary. It's not really salivary because it's not in your saliva, but the back of your tongue has a few cells that produce this lipase that is acid stable, lands in your stomach, and begins to act on the fat that you've got, the fat. And it does that by breaking down the triglycerides into fatty acids and glycerol. All right, so, but notice what happens. Most of the digestion and absorption of lipids takes place primarily where? In the lumen of the what? Small intestine. That's exactly correct. Now, so you're going to run into patients, for those of you going to medical school, that have gallbladder problems. What happens with gallbladder problems when they eat a big old meal of lasagna? All that fat hits their duodenum and small intestine. And there is a bodily reaction, which you've studied in systems. It releases food-based hormones. And the gallbladder is supposed to squeeze and release that pancreatic juice into the small intestine. That doesn't happen if you got gallbladder problems. And all that fat just sits there and does what?
Nothing.
And the bacteria go nuts over it. And you get gas, and you get cramps, and you just feel terrible if you have all that cheese in your small intestine, all that fat in there, and the pancreatic enzymes, which are primarily responsible for the digestion of that fat, aren't there because you have gallbladder problems. All right. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You guys have a great Thanksgiving. We will see you on Monday.